Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. This show is for the week of December 4th, 2022. The global carbon dioxide level is hovering around 417 parts per million, well above the 350 parts per million that scientists say we need to get to in order to maintain a safe climate. Additionally, there are only 2,585 days left until the year 2030, which is, of course, the target by which we must reduce our carbon dioxide emissions by a factor of two. Anyhow, today we will enjoy another cross-posting with our friends at Franklin Matters, Steve Sherlock, who produces the show. We had the great opportunity to speak with Representative Jeff Roy, who is the chairman of the very important Telecommunications, Utilities, and Energy Committee in the Massachusetts Legislature. In the show, we talk about what are the prospects for 2023, given that the election is over, we have new insight as to what's got to be done. So I hope you enjoy hearing Jeff Roy discuss prospects for 2023.
And incidentally, I have had the opportunity to climb the 500 feet to the top of a nacelle and walk around on the platform on that nacelle and make some repairs to the engine in that nacelle. And that was all due to the availability of virtual reality equipment.
Steve Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet at WFPR.FM and in the local Franklin, Mass. Area FM dial at 102.9. Here today for another Making Sense of Climate episode number 19. How did we get to 19? Ted McIntyre, my guide. How did we do this?
I will tell you, for one of the first times since the COVID hit, we went over to some friend's house for dinner. And my friend looked at me and said, "Are you going to keep making those Climate Minute podcasts with Steve Sherlock?" And I was dumbstruck. The people actually listening, I can't, it is 19 episodes. That's a lot. So I'm very happy.
You were a celebrity, did you?
I didn't.
And we do have our celebrity here. His voice, I'm sure some folks may recognize, but with the introduction, our newly reelected Rep. Jeff Roy. Welcome.
Hey, great to be here. I'm in a good mood. It's a great day, and happy to be reelected, and so thrilled to be going back for another term. And hopefully, I'll be sticking with the telecommunications, utilities, and energy, or as we affectionately call it, TUE, because there's a great deal of climate work to be done, as the two of you well know. And I'm anxious to get moving on it. I've actually already started drafting legislation for the next session, because I think the pattern has been and will continue to have a climate bill in every session of the House of Representatives and Senate until we reach our climate goals. Whatever we can do to help us get along that path, that's what we're going to do.
Well, that begs the question, Jeff. What's in that? What's on that envelope that you scribbled with a light pencil as to what you're thinking about?
Well, a couple of the things that jump to mind. Green banking is something. How are we going to leverage private capital and government service to fund all of the green retrofits and other projects that we know are necessary, that we need a source of funding for that. And several states have done a green bank, and we're looking closely at that in hopefully trying to utilize the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center as the prime quasi-governmental agency to administer the funding under the Greenbank. So,
Jeff, just so that I can understand, it's my belief that a green bank is basically an organization that has money to lend out for projects that are green, that are good, but don't necessarily attract private investment. And so that a green bank can take a longer view and commit to making payments over a long, long period, but not necessarily trying to go through the Lehman Brothers hamburger, you know, to get money in Wall Street. Is that a fair statement?
That's fair, but we want to actually work in conjunction with these private companies to see if we can leverage their private capital with maybe some government guarantees or participation in the program. You know, believe it or not, things are finally becoming profitable in the green space. And I think companies are beginning to recognize that there's money to be made in going green. There's money to be made in saving energy. So we ought to be looking in this direction. And any assistance we can give as a government, I think, is a good thing, because there's a lot of retrofitting that has to be done, particularly in our buildings across the Commonwealth.
It's interesting. So what you're saying is the Green Bank would sort of be like it would be financially involved, but also kind of coordinating other monies, multiplying its own money by bringing in private sector money, but with the guidance of the wisdom of the of a green intent, right? That's
you
a great
it.
Idea, man. I like that.
You got it. And, you know, also leveraging the money that's going to be available under the Inflation Reduction Act that the federal government passed a few weeks after we did our state bill. So the timing is great. And, you know, we want to leverage all of that capital that's out there and put it to work to start greening our environment. I shouldn't say continue greening our environment.
Yeah. There's no time like the present, clearly. That's
exactly.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think having the Green Bank kind of facilitating that due diligence side as well. So clearly, you know, from a state perspective as to which projects need to be done, and then coordinating that side, then, you know, helping the marriage between the money and the need. That sounds like what's going to happen. So
it's an interesting, because I read somewhere that Senator Markey has proposed a green, quote unquote, green bank. But in that case, or at least I think the proposal would be that the Green Bank at the federal level is backed up by the Fed, right? And they can print money, right? So that the investment is absolutely safe. And some, it's almost, it's, you say, once you start thinking of a green bank at the state level, well, we cannot print money. But if that was backed up by a federal thing that has, you know, the security of the full faith and honor of the U.S. dollar behind it, that's a interesting. Well, that's a great idea, Jeff. I would be interested to follow that going forward.
Another piece that we're looking at is smart metering technology. I think in the last show that I was on with you folks, I talked about a device that I had put into my electrical panel that makes my system a little smarter. But I'd like to see that technology actually at the meter, exchanging information between the homeowner and sending it back to the utilities so that they can actually see, you know, how the energy's been being used, when it's being used, control when the energy's going out, offer customers rebates if they utilize energy off peak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's something that we have some legislation that has been proposed in the past, but I think moving that forward to require the utilities to put these smart meters in homes, I think is a good move. And, you know, we'll certainly pursue it. And
little bit on that before we go further, I think, you know, people hear smart meters and government oversight, even private oversight. What's privacy going to have happen to it in there? And To a certain extent, yes, there are some privacy concerns, but I think that was one of the things that you started looking at as well. And even from my security perspective, to the extent that electricity, when you come down to it, and certainly I'm not the electrician by any means, I don't have a technical background, but it is a wavelength. So if AI and the technology can interpret wavelengths to define them to a device and thereby start incenting using that device in the off-peak hours versus the peak hours, and then conceive of that on a grander scale, that has to help us. And yeah. I don't think there's enough of a real privacy concern in that case because of the beneficial goods that outweigh that piece. My two cents.
Well, I'll share with you that, using the smart metering technology without a smart meter, there are ways they can do it. I received a $52 rebate on my electric bill this month because I gave National Grid control of my electric vehicle so that they could turn off my charger during the peak periods. Ooh. And bring it back on in the off peak. So that vehicle was being charged off peak.
Yep.
And earned me $50.
While charging.
Right.
That's fantastic. And it is a concrete example. I was trying to talk through why the off-peak was useful. What you're saying is that you have actually implemented the option where the utility knows your EV, gorgeous EV, by the way, is demanding power, right? And if the entire grid is needs too much power and is turning on dirty power plants in order to generate the electricity, then the grid's smart enough to turn your EV off, reduce the demand, and so now you don't have to turn on that coal-powered power plant someplace in the state, right? And everything's greener. I mean, that's a way to manage the grid. That's yep. a great example of why this technology is useful, right? Because yep. you can match the demand to the supply in the most green way.
Yeah, why it worked with my vehicle is because my vehicle has Wi-Fi settings. So by granting National Grid access to the Wi-Fi in my vehicle, they knew when I was demanding power.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was during a peak period, they would actually send me a text and saying, we need the power. We'd like to shut your vehicle off. If you want to override this, text back stop. Otherwise, we'll automatically do it. It didn't matter to me when the vehicle was charging. All I wanted to do was when I woke up in the morning, I wanted it to be charged.
Sure.
So whether it started charging at 5 in the afternoon or 1 in the morning did not matter to me. So I was happy. I never overrode their piece, and I was delighted to get money back as a result. And so I was saving money, and I was also helping the environment by not contributing to the demand when I didn't need to. And if we get these smart meters in people's homes, you can do the same with dishwashers, with clothes dryers, with any devices that you don't need running during peak periods. And I think I just signed up for another one with Eversource on my gas. I have a Nest thermometer.
Okay. Yep.
And they said, if you give us control over your thermometer so that we can, lower your temperature when there's a high demand, we're going to give you rebates. So, I'm working with them there. Those are particular devices I have in my home. The smart meter would control everything from the exterior of your home. And I'm talking about that meter that hangs off the side of your house. Most of us have dumb meters. If we can put smart meters in, that would give the ability to save on so many devices in our homes.
And that whole thing speaks to the importance of what people refer to as the built environment, right? People's homes are the place, homes and buildings in Massachusetts are the place where lots and lots of carbon pollution is generated through heating and whatnot. And there's many, many implications of how do you reduce carbon emissions from homes. And you're on to this particular one of managing the demand, which is an interesting thing, but it's a big topic. There's lots of ways to go once you start thinking about how do we reduce demand from the built environment, which is this fancy word for saying everything, every place we live in, right?
Yeah, if we can reduce the demand, it goes a long way towards lowering emissions. Like you said, we don't have to activate a coal-fired plant. Of course, there are no coal-fired plants left in Massachusetts, but we certainly have natural gas peaker plants and oil-fired peaker plants. And to the extent we're able to keep them off, we're going to lower the emissions. And one way to do that is to decrease the demand.
I think, and related to that, we can segue into our stretch code topic, because I think the stretch code was something we wanted to address here, where the buildings as they are built going forward would have the ultimate in kind of the green technology, energy use sense technology. But then the other issue is the built environment. How do we retrofit the existing buildings so that they can then, you know, kind of catch up and stop, you know, digging the hole deeper for us? As I think we've discussed previously, I updated my oil burner at one point, and I think it was 2008. The next thing would be a heat pump and or a geothermal provided heat pump of some sort. And when that is ready for an installation, then I'll sign up and step along. And I think that's one of the things that's on your radar. And I know there's a pilot underway in regards to a small geo district thermal heat pump in Framingham, I believe.
Yeah, it is in Framingham. Eversource is doing that project in Framingham. National Grid has selected a site. And they are going to be making an announcement within the next week or so about where they're going to be doing their geothermal pilot.
Okay.
You know, one thing when I was out in Denmark, there was constant conversation about district heat, and you know, we as Americans were, what are you talking about? What is that? And that's what these network geothermal pieces are. And they're actually in the city of Boston. They use steam generated out of Cambridge that powers most of the hospitals through generating steam and moving it through pipes, you know, underneath the Charles River and into the city. And they power all of these buildings so that the individual buildings do not have power plants. They rely on the steam coming from one central location over in Cambridge. And it's the, you know, it's a district heat type concept. I toured that facility a couple of weeks ago and learned about the major steps. I mean, this is a plant that's 100 years old. And it started off as coal, and you know, as they've made advances, it's amazing how their technology is operating less and less and less on you know, fossil fuels, and incorporating technologies so that this could become a robust source of energy that works well in a city. I mean, we couldn't be passing steam around, you know, suburban communities like Franklin, but it works great in the city. And similarly, I think these geothermal networks for neighborhoods is a great idea. The community solar projects that we see coming up are great ideas. And my obviously my favorite are the wind turbines in the farms off of the coast of Massachusetts. I'll share a funny story. Yesterday, I was doing an offshore wind conference in Boston, and the CEO of Ørsted had gotten up, and he spoke before me, and he talked about how Massachusetts is so proud that it's going to have the first commercial scale utility wind farm in the entire United States. And he said, that's not exactly true. He said, Ørsted is going to be first off of New York. And so I, of course, I went to my fact checkers the next day and I said, what's the deal? They said, well, certainly Massachusetts has broken ground first, and that's the Vineyard Wind Project, but Ørsted will open theirs first, but it's only 12 turbines as opposed to our 80 turbines in the Massachusetts project. So I said, okay, he was playing fast and loose with reality. 12 turbines does not, to me, amount to a commercial scale utility wind farm. And so Massachusetts, once again, will be first in this space. And he also said that Ørsted does not have a Massachusetts project. And when I got up to give my remarks, I said, Mr. Hardy neglected to use the word yet.
Yes.
Massachusetts has authorized already 5,600 megawatts of power, and we have 3,200 megawatts under contract today. That still leaves 2,400 megawatts, and I'm sure we will authorize more as the sessions go on. So that leaves room with the price cap having been lifted, that Ørsted has no excuse not to bid on the next project. And I certainly reminded the audience of that when I got up to give my remarks. So let's see if Ørsted does become a player in the Massachusetts market.
Yeah. And we want, I mean, we as the state of Massachusetts wants all those big players, right? There's Ørsted, there's, I can't remember the other, they're all European.
Equinor.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Go ahead.
Mayflower is one, Vineyard Wind, CIP.
What's the company that used to be called DONG? Danish oil, man. I don't want to even.
Dong, they were told if you're going to come to America, you might want to consider changing that name.
Change the name, please. Yes, that may not fly well.
And Vineyard Wind, they definitely not. That's Ørsted. Ørsted used to be Dong. I'm sorry.
My point being that Massachusetts, as an economic enterprise, wants to have the big global wind energy players in our backyard and hopefully headquartered here. And I think some of them have pretty significant offices. And so, again, I think you're right to invite Ørsted. If they're not already building something here, we want them here because we want those big companies, I think, right?
The headquarters is in Boston, Massachusetts. Right. And I said, it just makes sense that they have a farm off of Massachusetts. We've got the lease areas there. They do have a wind farm in the lease area, but it's going to be servicing either Connecticut or New York, not Massachusetts. But we certainly want them at the table. And when the next round of bids goes out in the spring, be anxious to see if they step up to the plate.
Tell me, Jeff, last time you were on, you made reference to having gone to a wind turbine test facility somewhere around Boston. Can you tell me the story about that? I mean, what's a...
Sure. Sure. That's a great facility. It's the Wind Blade Testing Center, and it's in Charlestown. And it's the only facility of its kind in the United States. The only one that's comparable to it is in Germany. And so what they do is they take the blades.
You mean one of the three big blades you see on a wind turbine? They have
exactly.
One of them, right? Yeah.
So what they'll do is they will mount them on the wall, and they will undergo a series of stress tests to see just how far they can bend them before they break. They will subject them to turbulence. To see whether they fracture, and they will age them in the course of a couple of months. They will age them out 20 years with this rigorous testing, and they give very valuable feedback to the manufacturers. Now, this facility was built 10 years ago, and the blades that, you know, were out in the first few years easily fit into this building. Hey, the blades are so long that they no longer fit in this building. So we are going underway to modify. I don't know why I'm lacking for a word, but we're expanding that facility to
extending it literally.
Yeah, it's another 150 feet that building has to be extended, and it's somewhat comical when you pull up to the facility. You drive up and you see this blade sticking out the door. They can't even close the door while these blades are there. And they're monsters. They're the size of football fields.
Well, I think that's a fascinating thing because they're subjecting these blades to stress tests, torture tests, basically. And I'm sure it's much more sophisticated, but it's probably something like hanging a 1,000-pound weight off the tip of the blade to see if the blade is rigid. Structurally strong enough to hold that weight out, right? And they probably shake it and do all kinds of put vibrations on it to try to break it, right? Because it's much happier to break the thing in Charlestown than it is out on the Atlantic Ocean. Yeah. So this is a great thing, and it's high tech, a lot of scientific stuff in its jobs. I mean, I think it's
and it's unique. It's the only one of its kind in the United States, and it's right here in Massachusetts. And the day that I was touring the facility was the day that the Museum of Science happened to be filming at the center. And they'll be doing a whole video series on offshore wind and the testing facility. I bumped into the folks last week, and they said the clips are almost done, and they'll be sending them out to us for our approval, because they had us speak. And actually, I was there. My gift for going to the facility is I got a portion of a blade that they had cut out. It's like a 2-inch section of the blade, and it's a monstrous piece. It's probably about 5 or 6 feet wide. And that will be some artwork in my State House office. Gotcha. When they get around to hanging it up. It's actually pretty unique looking at the structure of a wind turbine blade and seeing, you know, the materials that make it up. And these things have to last 20 years. They do need to go through this rigorous testing. But I do urge you, if you get a chance, I know I'll be putting them out on my social media, but the Museum of Science will be putting them out on their website and social media as a way to explain what's going on in the offshore wind industry in Massachusetts.
That's great. I think having those little souvenirs, those little pieces of hardware. I remember my brother having a computer chip, right, business card, like in the early 1990s, and that was a real deal. You've got something from the very beginning. I mean, I don't want to geek out too far, but I mean, if you take a minute, look at the blades. They're very carefully sculpted, right? They have a really kind of funny shape, and what they're in order to generate a force on that blade that wants to push it down and rotate it, right? So there's so much modeling that goes into it. And then the thing has to be light enough and strong enough at the same time. So the materials engineering that goes into making literally a 300-foot-long blade, right, that's self-supporting and can take all that stress. I mean, there's lots of interesting work to be done there.
Yeah, and imagine installing those size blades onto a turbine out in the middle of the ocean, bouncing up and down on a boat,
floating with the tides.
it's an amazing piece, and I'm just so looking forward to seeing the job creation and the continued involvement with this industry. It's really poised to grow. If you want to see what an industry like this can do for a community, 60 Minutes, about a month or two ago, did a whole segment on Grimsby in England, which was a dying fishing village in England. And with the offshore wind industry, it has absolutely transformed the community and transformed the lives of the people who live there and brought the whole community back to life. And that's the potential of offshore wind. And think of a community like New Bedford. And I may have said this in the past with you folks, but it bears repeating. 100 years ago, the city of New Bedford was known for lighting the world using whale oil. And you know, obviously, we don't use whale oil anymore to light things. And the city has not, you know, done well, but offshore wind has the potential to bring New Bedford back as a way to light the world through offshore wind. And I'm excited for what that community is going to reap from an industry like this.
Jeff, I got to throw one more poetic image at you. So I grew up in New Bedford, and in front of the New Bedford Library is a picture of a whaler guy with a harpoon in a boat. And it's the marquee is a dead whale or a stove boat, right? Without going into the incredible environmental injustice of killing all the whales, right? The sort of bravery of that guy is likened to the bravery of the guy who's going to go out on a floating platform 500 feet in the air installing a wind turbine. And you can go to Gloucester, and there's the stalwart fishermen of Gloucester, right? These are like real stories about real people with real jobs. And I mean, that's where we're headed again under the kinds of things that you're thinking about. So again, I think it's those sort of, you know, real human images about what is happening are exciting, and people need to be aware of them.
And incidentally, I have had the opportunity to climb the 500 feet to the top of a nacelle and walk around on the platform on that nacelle and make some repairs to the engine in that nacelle. And that was all due to the availability of virtual reality equipment that allowed me to do that very dangerous work from the floor of a conference room in a building. And that virtual reality technology was designed and developed by an innovator in Massachusetts and with a grant from the Mass Clean Energy Center. It's a great teaching tool for young people who may want to say, hey, is this a career for me? Let me examine it doing virtual reality and see if this is something I'm interested in doing without exposing them to the dangers of climbing 500 feet up a turbine and falling into the ocean or, you know, dropping something. It's amazing what we can do today that we couldn't do 100 years ago.
And just to I mean, I think it's very interesting, and a point to be made about the available jobs is that there are jobs installing wind turbines, but there are a whole, the great thing about the economic opportunity is there's a whole industry of secondary companies that are formed to support the main industry. I mean, and one of the things I'm thinking of is there are companies that specialize in installing and managing the data communication among your 100 wind turbines, right? Because they're all talking to each other over Wi-Fi and whatnot. And somebody's got to manage that. And so you may not be the economic benefit to Massachusetts of having this cluster of companies around the majors is, it's like Detroit, right? You may not work for GM, but there's like 1,000 companies supporting GM in Detroit. And that's the beauty of this thing. So,
I'll remind you of the factory that's going to be built in Somerset at Brayton Point that's going to provide the cables for the turbines along the East Coast of the United States. Another, company that's out there, Franklin Sheet Metal. And our own Franklin, Massachusetts, is going to be doing some of the steel work for Vineyard Wind. I went in there for a tour just to talk to the owners, and they were excited to tell me that they were going to be one of the players in the offshore wind. And here it is, right on Cottage Street in Franklin, Massachusetts, part of that ecosystem that's underway. It's fascinating. It's exciting. And I love what it has to offer in the course of providing robust, clean energy that we so badly need as we transition away from fossil fuels. Some have suggested that the work that I'm engaged in and the work that I'm doing in this space is advancing too quickly and too costly. And obviously, those folks are not reading the reports that are coming out of the United Nations and the climate conferences that we put on, that we're running out of time to save the planet. That's my first point. My second point is, I don't think setting a goal of achieving net zero by 2050 is quick. That's 28 years. Okay, that's a long time. And some would say that that's not quick enough. But that's the goal we have in place. So if you hear somebody arguing that we're moving too quickly, ask them to read the reports, listen to your podcasts, all 19 of them. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure two more moving forward. And grasp and get an understanding of what we're trying to do here and what we're trying to do to save this planet for our children and our grandchildren. I'm going to be 89 years old in 2050. Whether it's too hot for me to go outside is probably going to be the least of my concerns at age 89. But my kids and my grandkids, they have much more at stake. And I don't want to turn over a planet to them that's any less habitable than what I have.
Yeah, and the other avenue, to your point, I would add is, okay, when do we start if we don't start today? Because we're digging ourselves a deeper, deeper hole every day we go forward. So let's just cut it and start and do. And yeah, it may be expensive, but what is the alternative? It's going to be that much more expensive down the road. And I think it's heartening to the extent that, you know, having been one associated and liking and reading around the sailing history between Gloucester and New Bedford, and having grown up in Rhode Island as well, you know, when you went before the mast, you effectively put your hand in the hands of the captain and you were gone for a couple of years, et cetera, to find out whether you liked it or not. And then you could then, once you got back, assuming you got back, then re-up and maybe move up before the mast. Yep. Here, to the extent that there is now, via the virtual reality and other training opportunities, you've got a much safer alternative to find any number of either physical labor jobs or electrician, carpenter, any number of other technical jobs that are going to be required for this industry to help us make the change.
Watch that 60 Minutes piece and you'll see a young woman who has taken on the task of climbing up these turbines and repairing them. And, you know, it's dangerous work, but she absolutely loves it. And you can see the passion in the way she describes the job that she does on a daily basis. And you see her in action and you're just so excited for her. And it's just a tremendous opportunity and a real nice rebuilding of Grimsby. The only thing I ever knew about Grimsby, it was an Elton John song from the Caribou album. but now I have a much better understanding of what's going on in that lovely little town.
We'll add that link to the show notes.
There you go.
Because you need that full spectrum of the experience. Well, let's go back. We did take a little of a segue. So we started talking about the building retrofits and the stretch code. And then, of course, we took a valid deviation and now we're back here again. So we get an opportunity. So the stretch code, and I believe MCAN was doing a public hearing that coincidentally was earlier this morning to gather some additional information, et cetera, around what could be changed to the proposal that is out there by DOER, I think.
Yeah, so it's an opt-in stretch code to begin with. It's a specialized stretch code that we had required as part of the roadmap bill in 2021. And we directed the administration to develop an opt-in stretch code that could allow cities or towns to take steps to really ramp up their efforts to be net zero. We asked the administration to define a net zero building. And I know that there was some aim or some had wanted the stretch code to allow communities to ban fossil fuels. The administration did not go that far. And we knew that the administration was not going to go that far. So that's why in the 2022 bill, we developed our own pilot program to allow up to 10 communities in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to ban fossil fuels if they saw fit. And we hope to gather valuable data from that experiment with those 10 communities as to whether or not that's a direction we ought to go in.
And Jeff, if I could just jump in for 1 second. There's a net, so there's a bunch of words there to unpack. There's net zero building code. Net zero usually refers to a building that emits no carbon dioxide.
Exactly.
Generally speaking, and the net zero comes from, you can imagine a circumstance where a building, you generate some carbon dioxide, but then buys renewable energy credits to net out to be net zero.
Yep.
A lot of the building code
uses carbon capture.
Right. Something like that. But then it sort of boiled down to the idea that a net zero residential building should be electric only, operating on heat pumps. That is to say, you only have electricity in your house. You have an induction oven, you have an electric clothes dryer, electric water, hot water heater, a heat pump. And that allows you to be, like, really, when you say ban fossil fuels, it means that in new construction, you don't allow new gas hookups, right?
Exactly.
That was the, I completely support this idea that we have 10 towns, let's do the experiment, collect the data, and see where we stand. So give it back to you, Jeff. So I just wanted to jump in and say that.
No, I'm glad you did, because I use these terms every single day, and I forget that a lot of people are saying, what language is he speaking? On top of all of that work, there's a Clean Heat Commission that is studying all of these issues, and that group is slated to release its report this month. It's November of 2022. So we'll be looking at another series of recommendations about what we can do for retrofitting buildings, new construction. And I truly am awaiting that report. I almost wish that report had come out before the specialized stretch energy code, because I think there's going to be some valuable information that's going to come out in that report. And, you know, these two vehicles are going to be great jumping off points for the new administration, which is going to be sworn in January. We have a new governor, a new lieutenant governor. We'll have a new secretary of energy and environmental affairs. We'll have a new commissioner of the Department of Energy Resources. We'll have a new chairman of the Department of Public Utilities. So there's a lot of change about to take place as a new administration is seated. And that means significant things for things like the opt-in stretch energy code and the Clean Heat Commission. So
those are two vehicles in the sense of two mechanisms for reducing carbon emissions. The specialized code would be from new buildings, and the Clean Heat Commission plan would be finding ways to reduce carbon emissions from existing buildings. And those two in tandem cover the waterfront for buildings, which again is a place that we need to be going.
Yeah, absolutely. We're seeing weather events. We're seeing warming waters, rising waters. All of this stuff needs to be taken into account as we are building buildings around them. We don't want Franklin to become a coastal community, but that's
I mean, I live here in Franklin next to a school, so I see kids going back and forth every day as they go in and out of the school. The other day, it was 75 degrees in November. And a kid in fourth grade has no idea that that is just not normal. And it's our job to do something about it so it doesn't persist. I mean, as you say, things happening. Yeah, right here in Franklin, it was moist in 75 closing in on Thanksgiving, right? My pilgrim hat was hot and sweaty.
Yeah, and yesterday I was walking, my conference was in the seaport, and I was walking along the ocean, and I was grateful that I had taken my winter coat. Whereas I was in a t-shirt 2 days earlier, I was bundled up in my winter coat as I was walking along the Seaport Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible.
Yes. Yeah, the waterfront there, having spent many lunch hours and post evenings while I was working, the waterfront there can be rather brutal at times.
Yes, it can.
And coming back to the stretch codes in Franklin, I do recall, and I think you may have not been on the council at that time, having moved on, but the council did approve the prior stretch code for our building codes. And I'm assuming at some point in time, once this new code becomes available, it'll be an option for the council to approve, having gone through the usual channels. I'm sure Economic Development Committee, Planning Board will weigh in before they'll come to take a vote next year, the year after, whenever. But that'll be something from a Franklin perspective we can watch for.
Absolutely.
See what happens with it.
That's certainly on the horizon.
Sometime TBD.
Yep.
One of the things I had shared previously, you had a spot, I think it was with Channel 5 and Ben.
Ben has your back.
Ben has your back on some Mass Save pieces. And I know you're still working on that. So you might want to provide an update for people who may not have heard that yet. And we'll include the links so they can go back and we can give you the fresh update opportunity here.
Yeah. So, Mass Save had reached out. Ben Simino from Channel 5 had reached out to me. He had received a number of complaints from people around the Commonwealth who were complaining that there were delays in processing their rebates on retrofitting in their homes. You know, people had installed heat pumps and, other high efficiency devices in their homes. And part of the promise is if you do these types of retrofits to your house, the Commonwealth will help pay for that through the Mass Save program. And I don't know how many people are aware of it, but if you look at your electric bill, you'll see that any number of dollars comes out of that bill on a monthly basis and goes into this fund that finances all of these rebates for projects that we are encouraging you to do to get your home ready for the transition. And the program underwent some major changes at the beginning of this year in January as new programs were rolled out and higher incentives were offered. And that led to some hiccups along the way and delays in processing the rebates, and people were calling over to Mass Save and they were referring them to the utilities, and the utilities were pointing their fingers back to Mass Save, and these poor people were frustrated and not getting anything. So Ben Simino got involved, and then he reached out to me as the chair of Telecommunications, Utilities and Energy, and I went on to his show and said, look, we understand there are some bumps in the road, but 6 to 8 weeks is a reasonable time to process a rebate. Anything beyond that is unreasonable. And if the folks at Mass Save are not going to fix it, the legislature would be happy to jump in and provide a legislative fix. And I'm happy to report at the end of that show, both of the customers who were on there had gotten their rebates rather quickly due to the intervention of Channel 5. And I've had constituents reach out to me over the course of the last year with the same problem. And, I'm able to get through to the utilities and say, hey, you got to help these people out. But that's not the way it should work. You shouldn't have to call your state representative or your state senator. The system should just work. And if it's not working, have a way that constituents can contact MassSave or the utilities. Hire an ombudsman who can address these concerns and complaints and get this stuff taken care of. There's no reason. We need to develop confidence in the MassSave program, and we have to inspire people to participate in this so they retrofit their homes so that we can have a cleaner built environment. And that's our goal. And if you frustrate them by presenting roadblocks, you're not going to get the work done. You know, I've said that with my electric vehicle. If we don't bolster the infrastructure with charging stations along the Mass Pike in every community across the Commonwealth, and we subject our drivers to range anxiety because they don't know where they can get a charge and how far their vehicle will go, we're not going to transition to electric vehicles. We have to make it as easy as it is to get gasoline in your tank. It should be that easy to get an electric charge in your vehicle. And that's why in our latest bill that we did in 2022, we're spending $50 million to upgrade the charging infrastructure across the Commonwealth. And the federal government is throwing in additional millions of dollars to enable us to upgrade the charging infrastructure along all of the interstate highways in the nation. So great efforts to do this, but it's important that we do this so that we encourage and incentivize people to move in this direction.
Well said. Putting in charging stations, I can tell you, my son tried to rent a car, and by happy circumstance, he was given a Tesla. So he and his fiance decided that we're headed off to Albany or someplace, driving down the Mass Pike, no idea where they could get a charge. You know, they ended up in New Hampshire somewhere to try and find a charging station because that's what the...
They went to New Hampshire on their way to Albany?
Well, they had to find a charging station. So, I mean, I think the thing you're talking about, putting charging stations in as being a critical element, is really a good thing to do. But I guess I wanted to go back to the MassSave issue and sort of raise a related question that you're aware of. But, I mean, there was an article in the Globe recently that the town of Wellesley wanted to put in, so now we wrap around to all the same terms. They were putting in a net zero building powered entirely by heat pumps and whatnot. They did not need any gas lines. But then MassSave came to them and said that they would go and give to the town of Wellesley another $1.5 million if they would just install this cute little gas pipeline up to the school, and that, of course, $1.5 million focuses the mind, right? So all the people planning it said, should we take this? Should we just put in a pipe? You know, blah, 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 back and forth. And it wasn't until the Globe sort of sent an email to MassSave saying, can you please explain what this request is for, how it's justified? And then suddenly the problem was solved. The offer was retracted. The implication being that MassSave is a creature of the utilities. And since the utilities want to install pipelines in order to preserve their business model, they're willing to use MassSave in this kind of underhanded way. Maybe I'm being overly negative about the whole story. You can correct me. But, I mean, how can we make MassSave, which is an organization mandated by the state but run by the utilities, keep it well aligned with the major roadmap goals of carbon reduction?
Does
that make sense, Jeff? I hope I didn't bias the story too much.
You know, let me say that MassSave program that we have here in Massachusetts is one of the model programs throughout the nation. It really offers great incentives. I've talked to people from New Hampshire saying, we have nothing like that in the state of New Hampshire. There's no incentives like what you have in Massachusetts to do all these retrofits and programs. So let me give them a pat on the back for having a great program. There are bumps along the way. And luckily enough, we have some very bright people who know how to make noise in Massachusetts, and you know, keeps it on the straight course. There was no reason for them to insist on a gas pipe in a school in Wellesley. Wellesley can handle a building with just heat pumps, and you know, that realization set in, and you know, media had to get involved. Not optimal again, but that's you know, that's part of the checks and balances that we have in our system. The media is the fourth estate, the fourth branch of government, some would suggest. So, you know, that helps us, you know, get along our way. But I do expect and anticipate that we'll see legislation looking to make some changes in the way MassSave is run in light of the story that appeared in the Globe, in light of what the story that appeared on Channel 5. And so we'll be taking a look at those types of pieces of legislation to see if we do indeed need to make some changes. I have the confidence that they see all of this on the news just like we do, and they're going to tighten their belts and they're going to right the ship, and we may not have to do anything. But it's good that you have a legislature that's staying awake and well aware of these problems and is ready to jump in if we have to.
That sounds good. And I think tying back to your original comments in terms of, and I think we even covered it last time, where you're anticipating probably another legislative bill each year with a new governor coming in, it might make that process a little bit easier, a little less agita-inducing, perhaps. Anything you want to indicate in that?
To coin a phrase.
You've been reading some headlines about Governor Baker and his agita. Hopefully, Maura Healey has a better diet and she won't have those issues as she goes in. I'm really looking forward to working with her. I've had the opportunity to work very closely with Maura Healey as the Attorney General. They play a major role in what happens in the energy space in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. So I'm on speed dial with her office already, and anxious to see her now in the driver's seat in the corner office, and anticipating a very good continued working relationship. But, you know, it all remains to be seen. You know, she's got to set her benchmark for how she's going to lead, and that remains to be seen. But I'm encouraged by my past history with her and think that we'll be able to accomplish some really good things together, because God knows our environment needs the work, and we have committed people on all sides of the spectrum in our state government, and ready to see how she pitches it to us. And the thing I'm really anxious about and looking forward to seeing is who she puts on her team. Yeah. Who's her going to be her Secretary of Environmental and Energy Affairs? Who's going to be the DPU commissioner? Who's going to be the commissioner of DOER? She has also indicated that she's going to put a climate czar in her cabinet, elevate a position who will make the secretariats talk to one another and consider environmental issues in everything they do. You know, Department of Transportation ought to be thinking of climate change issues and having this interface on the cabinet to make sure that they are, and coordinating with EEA and DOT and any of the other agencies, economic development, housing. They all have a role to play in climate change. And I think that's the thing that's most exciting for me, seeing that she has put a climate czar as a goal for her in her cabinet. And I'm anxious to see who this new team is going to be, because obviously I'll be working very closely with them.
And with the election, as we talked of, clearly we've got four major roles, all female, all women led now in Massachusetts. We'll see what the rest of the team fills out in as they go forward with you know, as she fills out her team, to your point. But in the meantime, we thank you for spending time today with Ted and I, helping me make sense of climate. So I'm a little bit more educated, and I hope the listeners a little bit more understanding of clearly the work involved, the challenges that are ahead of us, and yet the willingness to do the work that's necessary. And we appreciate that on your behalf.
Yeah, I will say, as I've said continuously, this opportunity to represent our communities in the House of Representatives is the greatest opportunity I've ever had in my life. I thoroughly enjoy the work. I give my heart and soul to it. And I don't care what the task is that's put in front of me. I put all into it. And I'm encouraged to have folks like Ted McIntyre, who's a well-recognized climate scientist in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, as a constituent that I can pick up the phone and ask him questions. I'll shoot him an email and he can answer it. So it's exciting to be here and doing this work. So I thank you for calling attention to it.
It's one of the major challenges in front of us. So we will get there.
Yep.
However we can.
Yep.
Thank you again. Thanks, Ted, for helping us. And again,
my
19.
Pleasure.
19, even in the cribbage world, it's an impossible number. But guess what? We did it.
Who's your guest on number 20?
We got to figure that out. We've got
to be a bottle of champagne, I think.
Yeah.
Got a host of opportunities. Yep. So we'll figure that out. For the listeners, thank you for joining us. Come back. There'll be more. And one other quick reminder. We do this because Franklin matters. We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.
So there you go. Our thanks to Jeff Roy for coming on the show. We look forward to chatting again. Take care.
Very cool.